Just as I was going to call the Uber, Jo pushed my hand down, shaking her head. A random limousine pulled from the Lawrence driveway into ours. When the door opened, I'd tried to tell the driver he had the wrong house, but Lori popped out of the roof of the car. It was an older limo and looked sort of tacky, but Joe's face lit up like the 4th of July when she saw him bow his head and raise his hand like an usher to guide her into the car. I didn't like the way he turned away after helping her in, like I wasn't even there. It wasn't the attention I was jealous of. It was that I didn't think he was good enough for Joe. Joe needed an old soul with a steady hand and durable ego. Her suitor needed to be reliable enough to guide her and keep her emotional whims grounded. Lori, the European-raised grandson who wore Chelsea boots and a man bun, Joe wasn't ready for that type of maddening teenage dream. "Your chariot awaits, spring girls," Lori yelled to me as I struggled to get past a big box on the seat. "I'm not Mr. Lawrence, I'm Lori," he was telling Joe as I sat in the seat directly across from them. A 3-foot gap was between the two of them. His hands were twisting off the top of a glass Coke bottle in his shirt, and Joe smiled when he handed it to her. "Lori Lawrence, what an odd name," Joe said, and lifted the bottle to her lips. "No," he laughed. "My first name is Theodore, but I don't like it. If you must know, when I was young, the guys in my class would call me Dora, so I changed it to Lori when I started high school. We moved to South Italy from North. It was easy to start over." Joe's shoulders shifted in excitement, and she tapped her Coke bottle to his. They looked like they were going to prom, but Joe refused to go to prom or homecoming or even football games. I was at every one, cheering in the student section. We couldn't have been more different. When they took another drink, a thin rope of soda spilled over Joe's lips, down her chin, and onto the light denim dress. "Tell me about Italy. I need to hear everything," Joe said, wiping at the stain with her hand. She was giving me a migraine. Lori handed her a napkin and told her it wasn't that bad. She laughed and sat back against the leather seat. I noticed a sense of familiarity with him that I thought was off, but the most I could do was talk to my sister about it later. Maybe every girl, even Jo, needed a Lori to waltz into her life and right back out, leaving her deflowered and ripened. Maybe that's what Jo needed to fully develop. She was sort of stuck at that shy, homebody girl stage, and that was great for her, but it made it harder to make friends in school. Then Lori started speaking about his school in Vevey, where the guys all have the same haircuts and they try to sleep with their tutors. When they went on their spring breaks in Switzerland, they told the other boys about their attempts and Lori didn't say it, but Joe and I both knew it must have made them feel more like men. I felt weird witnessing Joe's first ongoing flirtation with a boy. We had no brothers and very few male cousins, and those cousins we had we didn't even know, so boys were like a different species to us. I got past that in 7th grade when I got my period and my chest and hips grew. Boys started to notice me, and girls started to be mean to me. I never wanted to run the school like Shelley Hunchberg, but I wanted to have friends. I settled for a group of semi-awful girls who mostly just obsessed over YouTube and matte lipsticks. They became more awful the older we got, and they took someone else's side over mine, and from then on we hadn't spoken to one another. I didn't want Joe to go through those social trials. No matter how teachers or parents wanted to deny it, the years between 16 and 20 were hard. Joe was at the beginning of the trial. I zoned out whatever Lori was feeding to Joe and stared out the window. It wasn't a far drive. I was already walking into a wasp's nest. I needed to stop worrying so much about Joe, too. I wanted to keep my sister sheltered, but I didn't think it would help her in the long run. To feel anything, you have to know the highs and the lows, I thought. If I kept Joe away from making her own mistakes, she would never learn how to navigate. I saw it all the time with my friends. Their parents coddled them, and they learned nothing about how the real world worked. And the moment they were fired from Forever 21, they hysterically called home, their iPhones clutched in their shaking hands, and begged to come back. I saw it time and time again. I still lived with Meredith and planned to until John and I were engaged. I didn't know when it would happen, but I knew it would be somewhat soon. In the military, it was even better for your reputation if you were married. I was completely ready to be the perfect officer's wife. I still had some learning to do before I mastered the domestic parts of my role, but I had the social cues down. Even though Joe didn't see it, there was more to being a military wife than baking and chauffeuring a van full of kids around. It was about being strong, being capable of running an entire household, and supporting your husband and country in the best way you could. We passed a row of big houses, so I knew we were close to the King's Place. Joe and Lori were still babbling about Europe. John Brooke would give me the best of everything. He was stable and handsome. He was the whole package. I had lusted after security my entire life. That's something Shia would never have been willing to give me, despite his family's money. He was ready to throw everything away, adventure after adventure. John could give me stability. John Brooke was a nice guy who didn't talk much, but when he did, he always had the wisest things to say. Meg said my dress is too big. She made me wear it. I heard Joe tell Lori when he helped her out of the car. You can laugh too, she said to him while looking at me with a smile on her face. Lori didn't laugh. He only looked down for a second and whispered something to her that sounded like, you don't have to wear a dress. And she stuck her tongue out at me. I couldn't help but laugh at the tiny fleck of innocence left in her. I knew it was going to evaporate soon. I had noticed her body beginning to bloom over the past summer. Joe grabbed my hand when we got out of the car and squeezed it tightly as we walked through the gate of the King House again. Shia was standing in the doorway, and he saw me before I could dodge him. I tightened my grip on Joe's fingers and leaned in for Shia to kiss my cheek. I didn't want to be formal with him, but I had a role to play. So did he, which is why he kept his lips pressed to my cheek only just as long as he needed to. I pulled away and stepped back. My maroon dress was already clinging to me in the time between leaving the limo and walking to the front door. The estate looked entirely different from the night before. It had been less than 24 hours since I had been here, but it was completely transformed. The first difference was that there was no crowd. The kings were all lined up on the stairs, waving like true diplomats, and then there was Belle Gardner, her hair slicked back into a tight bun. Little hairpins were sticking out of the sides, and I could smell the hairspray on her from feet away. Without looking at me, Shia smiled at Joe. Thank you for joining us. It'll be fun, I promise. He squeezed her shoulder, and I watched her relax. He was good at that. I looked over to the side to find Lori staring at me. Joe looked at him and then at me, and her shoulders slouched a little. Lori waved at me, maybe it was mockingly, but I shooed him away and gave my jacket to a man at the front who looked an awful lot like Christopher Walken. First, I headed toward the hallway bathroom. Unfortunately, Belle and her mother stood exactly in my path. Avoiding them, I crossed through the kitchen instead and spotted Mrs. King. She was standing next to the marble island in the center of the open kitchen. Jagged gray swirls cut through white marble, and the paint on the archways and crown molding was the exact same shade of gray. The room looked like an old parlor. Meg, she said when she noticed me. Her elegant hand held up her wine glass, and she gave me an imperial smile and waved me over. Joe and Lori followed, and I shamelessly hoped that Mrs. King wouldn't see the stain on my sister's dress. Mrs. King set her glass down and hugged me. Lori kissed both of her cheeks in that way that they could do correctly because they both had traveled to Europe. I saw Joe studying the gesture of Frère Labise, and I heard Lori explaining it to her as we all walked toward the dining room, and I just knew she would soon start air-kissing everyone she saw. Joe was definitely going to leave this town the moment she turned 18. She reminded us of that every day. A man with red hair stared at the top of Joe's dress, and I reached over and lifted the strap up her shoulder. My feet were killing me. I had barely let the blisters from yesterday heal before I put my feet through torture again. 12 chairs were spread around the long oval table, and I walked around slowly to find the seat with my name written on the little place cards. When I found my name, my seat was directly across from Shia and Belle, and 4 seats down from Joe. I thought about asking them to move my seat, but I didn't want to be difficult. Throughout the dinner, course after course of delectable food was served. The entire 6-course meal was a lot like a typical Creole réveillon dinner, which was a staple of a New Orleans-style Christmas, but the Kings were having it on New Year's Day. Somehow, that seemed fitting. This family could change the date of Christmas itself, and many people would follow. During the meal, Joe talked to Lori and Shia King about the food, although I also watched her gag at the foie gras on the little plate in front of her. She picked around half of the courses, and Shia ate a bite of souffle from Belle Gardner's fork. The wait staff were quick and efficient. When Joe spilled a spoonful of leek soup on the table, they quickly covered the spot with a new napkin, and they used little hand-sized brooms to sweep the creme tablecloths between every course. I made it through dessert, the cocktails, and the coffees that came after, and even the awkward speech by Mrs. King. She thanked her husband for his warm heart and thanked her son for spending the holidays with them, and I looked at Joe, who was looking at Lori. I dared to be rude and pulled my cell phone out of my bag. On the home screen was a notification of a text from Amy. How is it, lucky girl? You don't even know how lucky you are. I didn't reply to her, but I texted Meredith to tell her we made it just fine, even though it was late. Then I tucked my phone back into my purse and hung it on the back of my chair. I followed most of the conversation around the table. Everyone was talking about theater and galas and their own accomplishments. I nodded along to the pissing contest around me. Honestly, it made me feel a little bitter to sit there and not have anything to say besides that I was working for Mrs. King and used to work at Sephora. Even Belle had more to say than me, and she was a freaking bartender. Shia traveled the world, his family was loaded for Mr. King's success, and Mrs. King raised 3 functioning members of society. I couldn't even say I was an actual makeup artist. I was just good at it. The matriarch of the house did try to help keep me afloat in the conversation and complimented my talent for makeup, telling them how I managed to make her look 10 years younger. As I went to reply, Belle and her mom took control of the conversation, so I just kept my head nodding and my lips closed while the servers cleaned around us. I needed some fresh air. I was going to lose my mind if I didn't go outside for a minute. I noticed a few seats at the table were empty, so I grabbed my glass of water and stood up. I tried to get Joe's attention, but she was waving her hands around and looking back and forth between Lori and an older man I'd never seen before. I figured she was fine. Her cheeks were flushed and her shoulders were relaxed. Since she looked like she was lecturing them, I left. I took my time walking down the hallway and out to the back patio. I could only hear faint voices coming from the dining room when I got outside. The patio was empty, and I sat down on a black iron chair and leaned my elbows onto the matching table. I looked around at the perfect landscaping, and it intimidated me. So many things went into keeping a property like this. I'd always dreamed of a big house and a gorgeous yard. Yet I didn't know if I was capable of remembering to have the bushes trimmed. The twinkling lights from last night were still up, and it was a beautiful Louisiana night, about 70 degrees with a slight breeze that picked up the loose bits of my hair and pushed them back down. I was oddly at peace before my bubble was popped. Shia's voice was the thumbtack. Find anything interesting out here? I shook my head, not ready to give up my peaceful serenity outside and definitely not ready to talk to Shia. No, you should go back inside. Nothing out here to see. I tried to be funny, but it just didn't land, and Shia walked toward me and sat down across from me. The chair creaked when he sat down, and I tried to imagine how it felt growing up in a fairy tale land where even old outdoor tables are enchanting. But I knew enough to know it wasn't fair to say his life was a fairy tale. So, despite your having been here last night and tonight, my mom says you've been sick. Are you feeling okay, Margaret? He was already so close to me, and he leaned in farther. The crickets were even silent. I held my breath. I could smell the honey on his lips. He was so sly in that way. He made you crave him, but then he would vanish and leave you thinking you imagined the whole thing. I'm fine, thanks for asking. I turned the other way and unpinned my hair. I wondered if my makeup was still in place. I hadn't thought about it since dinner. Did I smell like shrimp gumbo? Shia King didn't smell like gumbo, or even the garlic-soaked artichokes I had watched him devour. He smelled like his earthy self, like rain and lumber with a hint of cologne. His outfit surprised me the more I stared at it. I hadn't allowed myself the liberty of taking him in fully, but now it was just us, and he was staring hard at the ground. His shirt and his jacket were almost the same color olive, and his dressy undershirt was buttoned all the way to his neck. Little black designs were printed on it, and he was wearing dark gray boots. He looked like he stepped out of New York City or Milan. I suddenly worried if he could see the outline of my strapless bra. I couldn't wear clothes like Belle Gardner could, but I knew I looked good in that maroon dress. I just had more to cover. I didn't realize you and my mom were so close. He eyed me and brought a glass to his lips. Until I heard you talking about me last night. I always knew you were more like her than me, but I didn't realize just how similar the two of you are.
She just wants the best for you, Shia. You're her only son. They want the best for you.
Oh my God, Meg, do you hear yourself? You're sitting here.
He paused, and his eyes focused in on me. He tapped his fingers on the center of the vine-like design on the table.
You're a clone of her. Last night, when I looked in the pantry, it was eerie how alike you looked. You were holding your glasses the same way.
His shoulders shuddered, and I recoiled. Part of me couldn't hide that I was flattered that Shia thought his mother and I were similar, but maybe that was why he liked me sometimes and hated me others. And he had called me Meg again, finally. You're lucky your parents care so much, I said.
Shia rolled his eyes and dropped his head back, looking up at the starry sky. I used to think you got it, Meg, but you just don't get it. It is what it is.
The way he shook his head made me feel like he was judging me immensely. I jutted my arms out and stood from the table. You don't know anything about who I am or what I get. If I had had any water left in my drink, I might have sucked it down or thrown it at him, I wasn't sure. I wanted drama. It was how we were.
I did at one point, and you know it.
His eyes were unwavering as they stuck to mine. I stepped around my chair and passed him to storm across the yard. If my shoes had been less murderous, it would have been much easier to make a classy, sassy getaway. Instead, I ended up on the ground, struggling to yank my foot from a dirt hole. Shia was standing over me, a flat look on his face as he pulled my shoe out. The heel snapped, and he pointed to my ankle.
That looks bad.
I shifted my eyes to where he was looking. My ankle was throbbing in an unnatural way. I hadn't noticed the burning pain until he mentioned it, which was weird. Joe would have a theory about that. She had theories for everything. I wanted to ask her.
Here, let me help you up.
Shire reached for my hands. I jerked away and shifted my weight, shaking my head.
Get Joe. I don't need your help.
He threw his hands up in the air, but didn't say a word as he walked inside to get my sister. I was humiliated in the worst way, and I could feel the tears stinging the backs of my eyes. I needed to get the hell out of there as soon as possible. I couldn't believe I had gone there anyway. What the hell was I thinking? I didn't know. I sat on the soft grass and waited for someone to come back. I should have stayed in my seat at the table, and I wouldn't have looked like such an idiot. Joe ran out the back door, moving so quickly in her flat boots. I should have been smart like Joe. My skin felt clammy. I've sprained my ankle. It was those stupid shoes, I tell you. I moved my body a little, and my foot throbbed. I don't think I can stand up. I told you those shoes were awful for your feet. They weren't worth it, were they? Joe rubbed my ankle. I need to get home. Call a car or something. I didn't know how I would get through or around the house, let alone into the car, but I would find a way.
Lori! Joe called loudly.
I scowled at her and swiped my hand through the air.
No way. Don't have him take me. I'm sure he wants to stay, Joe.
I stopped mid-sentence. Lori came strolling out of the house, Shia behind him. I was completely mortified. I bit down on my cheek and tried to lift myself up, but the second that I put all my weight on my knee, I fell back over and yelped in pain.
Meg, stop moving,
Shia told me. I huffed and would have told him off if Mrs. King hadn't been swirling in behind him. She looked concerned, but a touch bored. It was strange. I didn't want to be the center of attention in this crowd the way I usually did.
It's fine, I just need to get to the car, I told the gathering crowd.
I'll take her home, it's fine, Lori said, pulling his phone from his pockets. He grumbled a few words, hung up the phone, and shoved it back into his jeans. I liked the way he watched Joe everywhere she went. She disappeared and came back with a big brown stain on the stomach of the dress she was wearing. She was truly a mess. Mrs. King didn't even look at Joe. It was like she wasn't even there.
It's so early, Lori. You're sure it's okay? I asked.
Joe looked at him. Lori shook his head.
I always go early. I do, really. Let's get you to the car. It'll be pulling up any second. I'll help Joe get you home.
Lori lifted me up in his arms before I could protest, and I watched Shia's eyes burn into his back until we disappeared into the house.
16. Beth. Lori came barreling through the house, Meg stuck to one of his sides. His t-shirt was bunched into her fist as she hobbled. Joe was holding her up from the other side, and I checked for blood. I didn't know why, but I guess living in an army town will give you different instincts from your average person. I didn't see any blood, and Meg wasn't crying or screaming, so I rushed over to help. Meg's face was gray, and she was wearing a beautiful maroon dress that now had green grass tracks down the side of it. I dropped to my knees and gently lifted the bottom of her dress up to check her ankle before I moved it.
It's broken, Beth, isn't it? Meg cried.
Lori stood awkwardly over Meg with his hand stuffed in his pocket, bending at his knees.
No, Meg, it's just sprained. Let me get some ice. Don't move, I told her and climbed to my feet.
When I got to the doorway of the kitchen, I called back to Joe, don't let her move. Meredith walked into the kitchen, her hair in pins and her dress dragging on the floor.
What's going on?
I pulled open the cabinet drawer closest to her and grabbed the plastic bags.
Meg sprained her ankle at the King's. Looks pretty bad.
My mom pulled the freezer door open and helped me fill a bag.
Is that the Lawrence boy?
I nodded. He seems nice. She closed the freezer door and leaned against the counter.
I think so, too.
Meredith followed me back into the living room and thanked Laurie for helping Meg. Joe said the same to him and disappeared upstairs. She never came back. Laurie kept looking up at the staircase over and over for the next hour before he finally gave up and left. I didn't think Joe knew how to handle boys, especially tall ones with long hair like Laurie. It probably never occurred to her to even say goodbye to him. That was Joe. She was always in her own world. It was one of her best qualities, but she had to learn when to check back in. The next morning, I woke up before everyone else and started the coffee pot, fed the fish, and watered the plants. It was only 8, but I figured I should make breakfast. I didn't know if we had everything I would need, so I searched the cupboards and the pantry for ingredients. Eggs? Check. Milk? Check. Toast? I moved a bag of tortillas and found a loaf of wheat bread behind it. I thought a pack of bacon was somewhere in the freezer, so I investigated. Underneath a bag of frozen chicken breasts, I found a pound of bacon. I turned the hot water on and let it run over the meat to thaw it. I missed my dad and how he always woke up early with me and helped make breakfast. We would talk about music while we folded laundry, and it felt so deserved, that time with my dad. Looking back, I realize I thought those hours would never end. They seemed so infinite during the year he was here, even though they shouldn't have. I should have been used to him going. We all should have eventually gotten used to it, but it was the opposite. As I waited for the oven to heat up, I flipped the bacon over. My dad used to tell me about the concerts he and my mom would go to. They were Bob Dylan fans in the 90s, and I remember one year I heard them stumble into the old house in Texas, and my mom was laughing so hard that I thought she was crying. I hid by the doorway and watched my dad lift her off her feet after he chased her around the kitchen. I remember how tightly he hugged her to his chest when he finally caught her. The parents in my memory are so different from the ones I know now. But that's life. I was lucky to even have both of my parents under one roof. Amy strolled into the kitchen when the bacon had begun to smell up the whole house. Yum. She took a seat at the table. She pulled her phone out of her pocket and didn't say another word. Mentally, I kept coming back to the fact that Amy's pajamas were too small. The pant leg stopped at least 2 inches above her ankles. After a while, Meg hopped into the room and poured herself a cup of steaming coffee as I pulled the pan of bacon out of the oven. She hopped over to the table on 1 foot and sat down.
I think I spilled some,
she whined when her butt hit the chair. I told her I would wipe it up, and she smiled at me and told me thanks, that her ankle was killing her. Joe and Meredith were the last to join us, and by the time everyone was sitting down, Meg's face was turned into a grimace, and Amy's finger was still scrolling. Man, isn't it weird how now we are supposed to just go on with our lives after the holidays? Everything will go back to normal when you guys all go back to school, Meg said through eggs in her mouth. I wish it was Christmas and New Year's all the time. Everyone would be even more stressed and have even less money, Joe sniped. Joe, stop it, Meredith said, but smiled when she turned away. We all ate breakfast, and Amy talked about some food trading thing she was doing at school when they returned from break. I offered her whatever I could, and she blew me a lip gloss kiss from where she sat. Meredith said she had sent Dad an email last night and hoped he would be able to Skype today. I felt like the calls were coming less and less lately, and I had read the emails between him and my mom about his upcoming mission. I knew that his platoon was being sent on a mission because he said that he would be gone for over a week. I liked it much more when he stayed on the FOB. I wasn't like Joe, who read every hashtag, or like Amy, who was blissfully unaware of most current events. I was in my own lane, right between. And when you added taking care of my mom and sisters on top of that, I would say I had a toll road or two on the three of them. I was worried sick over Dad, and I hoped that he would call Mom soon. Meg, I need a ride to work tomorrow. I can't take any more days off this month. My manager will kill me, said Joe. She was picking at her plate. Her veggie omelet had to be cold by now. I made it before I made the French toast. Joe was the only one in the house who didn't fight over my French toast, except when Dad was home. My dad's mom taught me how to make it, using wheat bread and a little extra nutmeg and a dash of sass. I heard the last part in her voice. She had a Midwestern accent, even though she said there was no such thing. There was that voice again. Joe and my dad were the only people who could be trusted around a plate of warm chocolate chip cookies, yet the two of them would eat an entire bag of chips in one sitting. Joe and her bugles were best friends forever. The omelet I made sure as hell wasn't. Something seemed to be wrong with her. "I can barely walk, Joe. How can I drive you anywhere?" Meg pointed to her propped ankle. It was definitely much less swollen than last night. "I can't miss work again, and the bus takes so long to get anywhere." Meredith left the room, and I was going to follow her soon. Joe and Meg needed to figure this out on their own, and my mom seemed to be a little spaced out anyway. She was probably exhausted with worry. "Meredith," Joe said in a calm voice, "are you busy Tuesday? I can get a ride there, but not home." Meredith popped back in and asked what time she got off, and told her that she may have to wait an extra 20 minutes before she could get her. "I have to pick up Aunt Hannah from work, too," she explained. "Thank you," Joe smiled at Meredith. When my mom left again, Amy turned to Joe and said, "It's not her fault that she can't drive you, she's hurt." Joe seemed to consider what Amy was saying. She spun herself in the chair to face Meg. "I'm sorry. I know it's not your fault. I'm tired and finishing that piece. It's stressful." Meg couldn't even try to hide the surprise on her face. She was always so collected, and I could tell that Joe's honest apology shook her a little. "Me too." "Thanks," Meg replied, drawing out the word, sounding confused. "It's fine. I know you have a lot going on." Meg's shock transferred right on over to me, and something occurred to me. Meg and Joe had been spending a lot more time together than they ever had before. I had been hearing their voices at night lately, chatting away while everyone was in bed. I hadn't heard that sound since we were kids, when Meg used Joe as her cosmetic guinea pig after bedtime. Joe's pillow was always covered in makeup the next morning. "And why don't you just have Laurie take you, since he's your boyfriend now?" Amy touched Joe's arm, and Joe slid her hand away. Who would have thought Joe would have such a hot boyfriend? He's almost too hot. Amy touched the screen of her phone and looked back up to the three of us. Joe's response was flat. "Shut the hell up." "Just saying." Amy smiled and looked at Meg for approval. She worshipped everything about Meg. A few seconds passed, and Joe stood from the table. "I'm out," she announced and left the room. I was next. I needed to finish my history assignment on my mom's laptop before midnight. I knew I would regret working on a World War II assignment right before bed. It was 100% going to give me nightmares, but I was behind on my schoolwork because of lazy holiday fever. When I walked into the living room, Meredith was sitting in Dad's recliner with her eyes closed. I bent down over her to grab the laptop from the side of the chair. She opened her eyes, scaring the hell out of me. She started laughing when I gasped. "Sorry, baby," she said with a smile. She always looked so young when she smiled. My mom was beautiful, but sometimes it seemed like she had aged 5 years in one. I was worried about her and couldn't wait for my dad to be home. "I have an assignment to work on. I'll bring it back before I go to bed," I told her. She smiled at me, looking a little sleepy. "That's fine. You can do it down here if you want. I'll be quiet. I'm just going to watch Criminal Minds." She lifted the lever on the recliner and the footrest sprung to life. I laughed. "No way you'll be quiet if you're watching Criminal Minds." She talked through every scene, constantly trying to guess who the killer was and shouting at the TV. She laughed and shrugged. "I still think the FBI should have a watch on the writers of that show. It's some seriously twisted shit." She said that every single time we watched the show together. I was the only one who could stand to watch it. Amy was too squeamish, Meg was too big of a chicken, and Joe was too literal.
She would pick apart the plot holes and legalities of everything. I loved this time with my mom, when she was happy and distracted. "Come on, Beth, stay down here," she whined and pressed her hands together like she was praying. I tried to hold a straight face as I sat down on the couch and tossed her the remote. "Only talk during the commercials. Promise?" She dragged her thumb and index finger along her lips like she was zipping them and pretended to toss me the key. 17. In the few weeks that passed since Christmas, things had changed. Joe and Laurie became inseparable. Now that Shia was out of the country again, saving the world in his way, Meg was back to work at the King House. John Brooke would be home very soon, and it was all Meg would talk about. She was always so flustered while pretending not to be. Meredith kept herself busy, with Aunt Hannah coming over more than usual. Everyone was hunky-dory, except Amy, who got suspended from school for continuing to trade food in class after the teacher told her multiple times not to. Apparently, the principal was alerted when Amy was caught with a full-sized key lime pie inside her desk. A pie in her desk. When she'd asked me to make it for her, I didn't bat an eye. I figured it was for some school celebration. So I made her one from scratch that was supposed to be a homemade replica of Petite Amelie's recipe. So Amy was home with me for a week, and Meredith asked me to teach her while I was home. My online classes only took me around 2 hours a day to finish, so I had plenty of time during the next 5 days of her suspension. My sister was sitting across from me at the kitchen table. We had the house to ourselves that morning. "I want to go to Laurie's house again," she complained through a spoonful of her cereal. I dipped my spoon into the bowl and popped soggy rings of Cheerios into my mouth, and in the same mumbled manner she had spoken to me, asked, "Why?" "Because." Her sigh was heavy and dramatic. She was always the emotional one, more so than Meg even. Amy always seemed to be floating above the clouds. Meg was the most grounded of us, Amy the least. "They have everything there, a big yard. They even have a golf cart parked in the backyard," she whined. I thought of the scooters and the bikes my parents had spent months saving for, and had to remind myself that Amy was only 12. She didn't understand that she was being a spoiled little brat. "How do you know?" Amy was always sneaking around. I heard Meredith telling Aunt Hannah that she should put a password on her laptop if she didn't want Amy to go through it. "I just do." Amy had a glimmer in her eye as she went on. "We should just move in over there. There's a library for Joe, a piano for you, and Meg loves the greenhouse. I'm sure we can find something for Meredith." It was true. Old Mr. Lawrence had the most beautiful grand piano in his house. I had only seen it up close once, last week, when I went into the house for the first time. I smiled at Amy. "We might run into a problem getting old Mr. Lawrence to give up that big house to us." Amy nodded, her blonde curls rubbing against her shoulders. "You could convince him. One of us could even marry the old man." "Ew, you wouldn't." I gaped at my sister, mostly teasing, but I didn't like the way she was already talking, in only the 7th grade, about marrying an elderly man for money. Who knew where she got that? Maybe Meg?
"I would, so should you,"
Amy said in a faux southern accent.
"I would do just about anything for a better life. If I was old Mr. Lawrence's wife, I could paint all day and drink tea and be a proper southern woman."
Raising her spoon up, Amy lifted her pinky into the air. I laughed a little at the change in her voice, but I didn't like how quickly this conversation had gone awry. I needed to talk to Meredith about Amy's comment, but honestly, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know anything about getting married or even talking to the opposite sex. Instead of giving her bad advice, I said, "If you put as much energy into math as you do planning your life as a trophy wife, you could at least have a diploma." Amy smiled, and the dimples in her cheeks flashed at me. Her teeth were so straight, but just a little too small for her face, making her look younger than she was.
Whatevs. That term is never going to be a thing, Amy. Eye roll. It already is, Beth. Be happy with what you have. She shook her head. I want more. Well, if you want more, then work for more. No one is going to hand you anything, and the sooner you realize that, the easier your life will be. Look at Dad. He does all of this for us, to make sure we have a good life. I reached across the table and touched her hand. I know it's hard, but just try and be a little grateful. Amy looked down at the table and then back up at me. I thought he did it because of his patriotic duty. I laughed a little. That too. Now, let's go get your math booklet and let's do some work. With a sigh, Amy took one last bite of her breakfast and followed me to the coffee table in the living room, where I spent 2 hours teaching her how to long divide. Her school textbook was so much more advanced than I thought it would be. She was already learning to subtract fractions. I don't think I was learning that until at least 9th grade. I helped her add and subtract negatives without using our fingers, and she giggled when I got a few of the answers wrong. I quizzed her, and she got better each time. Sitting across from Amy, I felt like a big sister for the first time in a while. It felt like I was living inside one of those pure, family-friendly, Americana-themed television series where siblings hold hands and never want to rip each other's heads off. Meg used to watch one of those shows, and we were all obsessed with it. But for the life of us, we couldn't remember what it was called. We remembered that a curly-haired girl talked to the moon and that our neighbor had a crush on her, but not the title. A few months back, we'd spent an afternoon searching the internet for it, but failed to find it again. I got along with all of my sisters, usually. Jo and Amy fought the most, and consequently, they hardly spent any time together. Amy and I would hang out more since I was always at home. I wondered if she liked hanging out with me the same way she did Meg. I doubted it. Meg taught Amy how to straighten her curls with a flat iron and how to paint little flowers on her big toenail. When they were speaking, Jo taught Amy how to write short poems. They would read them out loud to each other, and I'd heard Jo telling Amy ghost stories about the French Quarter. Last Halloween, while Aunt Hannah watched Amy, me, Meg, Jo, and Meredith went on a ghost tour in the Quarter. The theme of this spooky tour was all about female murderers. It was awesome. Jo told Amy all about it when we got back and got cool points for that. Knowing Jo, she might have been trying to scare her sister, but instead it intrigued Amy. I tried to think of what I brought to the sister table for Amy, but when nothing came to mind, I distracted myself by asking, "What do you want to be when you grow up?"
"Old Mr. Lawrence's wife,"
she laughed. "Seriously." She shrugged and looked up at the ceiling. "I want to be like Meg."
"Meg? In what way?"
I didn't want to say that Meg hadn't accomplished much in her life yet, but I had a feeling that Amy meant that she wanted to look like Meg.
"You know," Amy shrugged, "I want to wear lipstick and tight dresses and be popular and pretty."
Amy's shirt had a little stain on the collar, and I wondered who taught her to care so much about being pretty. It's not your job to be pretty. It's your job to make the best for yourself, but it isn't your job to be pretty. You don't owe anyone that.
"Sure, Beth."
And honestly, I was a little surprised she'd even been listening to what I'd said. 18. Later that night, Jo was late for dinner, and Meredith sent me next door to collect her. Meredith had strict rules about all of us being home for dinner during the week. It was one of her things. We could go out before and after if we wanted, though I never found myself wanting to. I enjoyed peace and quiet and conversations with my mom and helping her with the daily routine that my dad left behind when he was deployed. Jo knew Meredith's rule and had never broken it until that week when she was late 3 days in a row. Meg was the only other one to ever break the dinner rule, but since she'd turned 18, Meredith let her do as she pleased, for the most part. Meredith could have gone to fetch Jo herself, but lately I'd gotten the feeling that with each day that passed, it was a little harder for Meredith to leave the house. We all helped as much as we could. Jo had been working much more than before and started paying her own cell phone bill. Meg was the taxi driving us around, and Amy, well, Amy was young and didn't help much. When I was Amy's age, I was already helping with dishes and laundry, but Amy was a very young 12, and sometimes it seemed like she didn't have a clue about responsibility. As I slid my feet into my sandals, I reminded myself that I was helping Meredith by going to fetch Jo. I hadn't left the house since I got Jo from the Lawrence house yesterday. Sometimes I would take long walks around the neighborhood alone, just to get some air and comfort Meredith. I knew she worried about my anxiety, but I was happier being inside and didn't mind my own company. I preferred it. Meredith was trying to find the bay leaf in the pot roast, and Amy was setting the table as I got ready to leave the house. It usually took me a few minutes to make sure I had everything. I sometimes wished I would never have to leave the house. I even had this whole invention idea to use those tubes like the bank does and send food and supplies through fast tubes so people would never have to leave their houses. Beth, are you almost ready? Dinner will be done in 10 minutes. Yes, Meredith. I walked out the back door and crossed the yard. I looked for any hint of life inside the bow window in the back of the Lawrence house. The kitchen looked empty from where I stood. Laurie and Jo were inside somewhere, and maybe that would be it, I hoped. Old Mr. Lawrence always intimidated me with his bushy eyebrows and scowling face. I had never seen a person who looked so annoyed at being alive. I wasn't exactly a ray of sunshine, but old Mr. Lawrence made me look like a rainbow. Laurie didn't seem to have his grandfather's permanent scowl. I had seen him be soft with Jo last Saturday, when he stayed at our house so late that they fell asleep on the couch together. Joe's head was leaning on Laurie's arm, and his mouth was slightly open as he breathed in and out. His body was so long that I almost tripped over his legs when I tried to wake them up. Their friendship made so much sense to me. Their insurgent personalities found each other at an army post full of people who follow commands in almost every part of their life. I thought that I would make a good soldier. Jo, not so much. She loved to question authority in every bit of her life. Sometimes this got her in trouble, like when she busted old Mr. Lawrence's window, or when she wrote a full-page spread in her high school's newspaper about the effects of PTSD on soldiers returning from war, and her teacher, Mr. Geckle, basically told her she had no chance of that article getting into the White Rock High paper, so she slipped it in just before printing. Luckily, she only got one day of in-school suspension as a punishment. I always hoped she wouldn't get herself into too much trouble, but knew that slipping pages into the newspaper was child's play compared to what she was capable of. When Jo was with Laurie, I felt a little less worried about her, and Josephine was the sister I worried about the most. She was the most inspired of us all, and she had passion that could burn a field of wildflowers, but I didn't know if she would be able to put it out when need be. She needed Dad. She needed someone who could help her turn her fiery passion into productive change. Jo was always a fighter, from refusing to have her Barbie date Ken to walking out of class when asked to dissect a frog. Dad was always good at bringing her back to Earth. He explained to her that Barbie doesn't have to date Ken, but they can be friends, and he wrote a note excusing her from the rest of the dissection project. I missed Dad, too. I missed how Meredith was when he was around. I knew as a military kid I was supposed to be used to this life, the year-long deployments with only 1 year between. My life was supposed to just go on as normal when he was gone. But sometimes it was hard. I often found Meredith curled up in his recliner with a wooden picture frame in her hand. Inside the 5x7 square was a picture of my dad before he became an officer, Staff Sergeant Frank Spring, in full battle rattle. His heavy gun was in his hands, and his smile took up his whole face. He always looked younger in pictures, Meredith would say. She would tell me so many things about him when I would help get her to bed from the recliner. Some nights she would cry, and other nights she would smile and tell me a happy memory from when they were young. I knew Meredith missed being young, and that made me a little sad for her. When I gently rapped on the Lawrence's door, my heart was pounding. I hated to be in situations like this when I wasn't sure what was going to happen. I liked when I knew where I was and who would be at the door. I wasn't great at handling the unexpected. I counted to 10 on my fingers and looked through the big window again. The kitchen was gloomy, all old cherry wood and dark granite. A huge clock was hanging on the wall set to 9 p.m., but when I pulled my phone from my pocket and hit the home button, it was only 20 minutes after 5. I knocked again, this time a little harder, then glanced past the kitchen into the living room. A row of picture frames adorned the mantle. I couldn't see the images inside them, but there were a lot. A shadow moving in the kitchen made me jump and edge away from the door. The shadow came closer, and I saw a flash of white hair. Damn it, Joe. Old Mr. Lawrence pulled the door open and waved me inside, then turned his back to me. He didn't make eye contact before he turned, didn't say hi, nothing. He did lead me to the staircase and wave his hand in the air again. I nodded to thank him and walked up the stairs. When he disappeared, I ran the rest of the way up. It reminded me of when I was young and would run from the dark hallway bathroom and jump into my bed, clearing the chance of something under it grabbing me. I didn't know which room was Laurie's, because when I came yesterday, I met them in the library. Now I passed a bathroom with a big clawfoot tub and a walk-in shower. The hallway was dark, even though the sun wasn't fully gone for the night. When I got to the next-to-last door, I could see a sliver of light cast onto the hardwood floor in the room. Walking slowly by it, I realized this was Laurie's room. My sister was lying on his floor with a book in her hand. Her usual relaxed face was wreathed in a smile, and she didn't notice me standing in the doorway. Laurie was on the bed, his eyes on his cell phone, and the speaker on his desk was playing soft electronic music. I knocked on the door and said my sister's name. Laurie called me inside. "You're late for dinner, so Meredith sent me over here to get you." Laurie didn't say anything, just lifted his head up, waved at me with his free hand, his phone in the other. I noticed that he had on loose-wearing bracelets made of strings and beads. Joe checked her phone and nodded. "We were just talking about the library here. You should see it. There's a huge piano in there. It's so dope." Joe sounded like a teenager from a Karen McCullough movie.
"I'm the only one who plays it, and seriously, I barely touch it. My grandpa's had it for fucking ever."
Laurie commented from the bed.
"Come in, Beth. You can sit down."
I walked to the chair in the corner of the room. A stack of magazines was atop it, which Laurie indicated I should move so I could sit down. I sank into it, and the black leather was warm and smelled like cedar and tobacco. A long body-length pillow was on the floor next to the wallpapered wall. The Lawrence house had more of a New Orleans feel to it than ours, likely because it was much older than ours. We were only the second family to live in our house, even though Fort Cypress was so very, very old. Meredith said there had been a fire in the original house, started by the youngest daughter of the last family to live there. The house burned to the ground, and the father was severely burned, but everyone survived. Our house was a newer build with gray siding and a deep porch. The Lawrence house was in the Greek Revival style on the corner of Nightshade and Iris, and it had more books and tchotchkes than I'd ever before seen in my 15 years. There was an old feel in the air of the place. It tasted like cinnamon and clove. There were shadows in every corner, and I immediately saw what Joe saw in it. Joe craved danger. And here it was, in the safest way possible. The creepy house didn't have a personality like that of our house. In the Lawrence house, darkness crept around the walls and lingered through the thick air. Laurie's room was full of things. Everywhere I looked, there were posters, records, books, barely a foot of uncovered space anywhere.
"Beth, what kind of music do you like? Your sister was just telling me you love Bastille."
Joe didn't say anything, and I didn't look at her. Laurie was nice, but I hated talking to people I didn't know. It made my skin itch. With a burning breath in my lungs, I responded, "I do. I play the piano and keyboard, a little on guitar, but I'm awful at it."
"Shut the hell up, you are not," Joe said from the floor.
She clicked her feet together. Her black booties were missing a buckle on one foot. I meant to fix it, but had forgotten. She broke it the same night Meg and Shia got into their last big fight a few months ago. Until this week, Joe had gone back to wearing sneakers and lace-up boots. I felt my entire face burn. I'm not that good.
I'm sure you're great.
Laurie smiled at me and set his phone down. My cell phone started ringing from my bag, and Joe sat up. The ringtone was an Ed Sheeran song that my mom had listened to every single day since my dad left. She's calling. I stood up quickly. I gave Laurie a little wave and waited for Joe by the door. She told me and Laurie that she had to run to the bathroom for a moment. Well, technically, she said, I'm gonna pee. I'll meet you downstairs. So I walked downstairs alone. I passed the room that I could see from the window in our kitchen. Even before I went inside, I had known about the piano from seeing Joe watch Laurie play it through the window, and I saw it up close and personal when I came into the house the first time. I looked behind me, hoping no one would be around. It was clear. There were always housekeepers or someone coming to the house. Or worse, I didn't want to run into old Mr. Lawrence again. I walked over to the piano. The sleek Siler was positioned just in front of a wide oak-paned bay window. It was the window I'd often watch Laurie play through. I slid my pointer finger over a sharp black key, and a thin layer of dust coated the tip when I pulled it away. I blew it off and sat down on the bench. The typically quick beat of my heart slowed slightly as I rolled my shoulders and lifted my hands in the air, my thumbs hovering over middle C. I didn't know how loud the instrument was going to be, but I tapped my thumb on the key to gauge it. It was pretty low, and I cared slightly less if someone caught me now that I was sitting here touching the keys. It had been so long since I had played on anything but a cheap keyboard, and since Meredith let me start homeschool, I had been using the old keyboard my parents got me for Christmas 4 years before. After playing for a few seconds, I realized I wasn't playing a song I knew. My fingers were playing the familiar keys of a song I was working on before I left school. I gave myself a few more seconds to play before I pulled my hands away and left the room. Seeing a shadow in the hallway on my way out, I hoped it was Joe or Laurie.
19. Meg. John was coming home today. I couldn't believe he was finally coming home. I had been counting down the days and the hours and now the minutes until he was back at Fort Cypress. I was dressed in a long black shirt with a heart neckline and cut-out shoulders. I wore a peekaboo shirt once before with John and he couldn't keep his hands off me. I hoped it would be the same this time. I had been playing over so many scenarios in my head regarding how it would go when John got back to me. I sat down at my vanity and checked my email on my cell phone. I had one from John. My heart sped up and I clicked it immediately. The message was from only a few minutes ago. The subject line read, "Tell me." "Hey, Meg. What's up? I've been thinking a lot about when I get home, and I don't think I can do this anymore. I'm confused. I'm sorry. Second Lieutenant Brooke." I read the message again and felt the blood drain from my face. After the fourth read, I tossed my phone onto the vanity like it was on fire. My makeup brush canister went flying and scattered brushes all over the floor. They rolled past my feet, and a thick kabuki brush stopped at the cutout toes of my Steve Maddens. I had gotten a blood-red pedicure because John liked my toes painted. He told me that once. I remembered every compliment he had ever given me. John Brooke didn't say much. His words came less often, but that made me appreciate them more. I was trying to be rational, to think before I made any moves, but it was hard. I didn't know if I should respond, delete it, or forward it to someone for a second opinion. Where was this coming from? John would be home that night in just 2 hours. What could have happened in the last day and a half that would make him so confused?
The last time we talked, he teased me about my dislike of superhero movies, and I promised to watch at least one with him. He talked about his mother up in Maine and his sister who had just had her third baby. There were no signs of anything.